Penguin Random House Audio presents The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars, by Deva Sobel. Read for you by Cassandra Campbell. Preface. A little piece of heaven. That was one way to look at the sheet of glass propped up in front of her. It measured about the same dimensions as a picture frame, 8 inches by 10, and no thicker than a window pane. It was coated on one side with a fine layer of photographic emulsion, which now held several thousand stars fixed in place, like tiny insects trapped in amber. One of the men had stood outside all night, guiding the telescope to capture this image, along with another dozen in the pile of glass plates that awaited her when she reached the observatory at 9 a.m. Warm and dry indoors in her long woolen dress, she threaded her way among the stars. She ascertained their positions on the dome of the sky, gauged their relative brightness, studied their light for changes over time, extracted clues to their chemical content, and occasionally made a discovery that got touted in the press. Seated all around her, another 20 women did the same. The unique employment opportunity that the Harvard Observatory afforded ladies, beginning in the late 19th century, was unusual for a scientific institution, and perhaps even more so in the male bastion of Harvard University. However, the director's far-sighted hiring practices, coupled with his commitment to systematically photographing the night sky over a period of decades, created a field for women's work in a glass universe. The funding for these projects came primarily from two heiresses with abiding interests in astronomy, Anna Palmer Draper and Catherine Wolfe Bruce. The large female staff, sometimes derisively referred to as a harem, consisted of women young and old. They were good at math, or devoted stargazers, or both. Some were alumni of the newly founded women's colleges, though others brought only a high school education and their own native ability. Even before they won the right to vote, several of them made contributions of such significance that their names gained honored places in the history of astronomy. Wilhelmina Fleming, Antonia Maury, Henrietta Swan Leavitt, Annie Jump Cannon, and Cecilia Payne. This book is their story. Part 1. The Colors of Starlight. I swept around for comets about an hour, and then I amused myself with noticing the varieties of color. I wonder that I have so long been insensible to this charm in the skies. The tints of the different stars are so delicate in their variety. What a pity that some of our manufacturers shouldn't be able to steal the secret of dye stuffs from the stars. Mariah Mitchell, 1818-1889, Professor of Astronomy, Vassar College. The white mares of the moon rush along the sky, beating their golden hoofs upon the glass heavens. Amy Lowell, 1874-1925. Winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. Chapter 1. Mrs. Draper's Intent. The Draper Mansion, uptown on Madison Avenue at 40th Street, exuded the new glow of electric light on the festive night of November 15, 1882. The National Academy of Sciences was meeting that week in New York City, and Dr. and Mrs. Henry Draper had invited some 40 of its members to dinner. While the usual gaslight illuminated the home's exterior, novel Edison incandescent lamps burned within, some afloat in bowls of water, for the amusement of the guests at table. Thomas Edison himself sat among them. He had met the Drapers years ago, on a camping trip in the Wyoming Territory, to witness the total solar eclipse of July 29, 1878. During that memorable interlude of midday darkness, As Mr. Edison and Dr. Draper executed their planned observations, Mrs. Draper had dutifully called out the seconds of totality, 165 in all, for the benefit of the entire expedition party from inside a tent, where she remained secluded, blind to the spectacle, lest the sight of it unnerve her and cause her to lose count. The red-haired Mrs. Draper, an heiress and a renowned hostess, surveyed her electrified salon with satisfaction. Not even Chester Arthur in the White House lighted his dinner parties with electricity. Nor could the president attract a more impressive assembly of science's luminaries. Here she welcomed the well-known zoologists Alexander Agassiz, down from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Spencer Baird, up from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. She introduced her family friend, Whitelaw Reed of the New York Tribune, to Asaph Hall, world famous for his discovery of Mars's two moons, and to solar expert Samuel Langley, as well as to the directors of every prominent observatory on the Eastern Seaboard. No astronomer in the country could refuse an invitation to the home of Henry Draper. It was her home, in fact, her childhood home, built by her late father, the railroad and real estate magnate, Cortlandt Palmer, long before the neighborhood became fashionable. Now she made certain the house suited Henry as perfectly as she did, with its entire third floor converted into his machine workshop, and the loft over the stable repurposed as his chemical laboratory, which he reached via a covered walkway connected to the dwelling. She had barely heeded the stars before meeting Henry, any more than she regarded grains of sand at the shore. He was the one who pointed out to her their subtle colors and differences in brightness, even as he whispered his dream of abjuring medicine for astronomy. If she feigned interest at first to please him, she had long since found her own passion and proved a willing partner in observation as in marriage. How many nights had she knelt by his side in the cold and dark, spreading foul-smelling emulsion on the glass photographic plates he used with his handcrafted telescopes? A glance at Henry's plate confirmed he had not touched the banquet fare. He was fighting a cold, or perhaps it was pneumonia. A few weeks earlier, while he and his old Union Army pals were hunting in the Rocky Mountains, a blizzard had struck and stranded them above the timberline, far from shelter. The chill and exhaustion of that exposure still plagued Henry. He looked terrible, as though suddenly an old man at 45. Yet he continued chatting amiably with the company, explaining anew, each time anyone asked, how he had generated steady current for the Edison lamps from his own gas-powered dynamo. Soon she and Henry would be leaving the city for their private observatory upriver at Hastings-on-Hudson. Now that he had finally resigned his professorship on the faculty at New York University, they could devote themselves to his most important mission. In their 15 shared years, she had seen his landmark achievements in stellar photography win him all manner of acclaim. His 1874 gold medal from Congress, his election to the National Academy of Sciences, his status as a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. What would the world say when her Henry resolved the seemingly intractable age-old mystery of the chemical composition of the stars? After bidding the guests goodnight at the close of that glittering evening, Henry Draper took a hot bath, then took to his bed and stayed there. 5 days later, he was dead. In the outflow of condolences following her husband's funeral, Anna Palmer Draper drew some comfort from a correspondence with Professor Edward Pickering of the Harvard College Observatory, one of the guests at the Academy gathering the night of Henry's collapse. "My dear Mrs. Draper," Pickering wrote on January 13, 1883, "Mr. Clark," of Alvin Clark and Sons, the preeminent telescope makers, "tells me that you are preparing to complete the work in which Dr. Draper was engaged, and my interest in this matter must be my excuse for addressing you regarding it. I need not state my satisfaction that you are taking this step, since it must be obvious that in no other way could you erect so lasting a monument to his memory. This was indeed Mrs. Draper's intention. She and Henry had no children to carry on his legacy, and she had resolved to do so on her own. I fully appreciate the difficulty of your task, Pickering continued. There is no astronomer in this country whose work would be so hard to complete as Dr. Draper's. He had that extraordinary perseverance and skill which enabled him to secure results after trials and failures which would have discouraged anyone else. Pickering referred specifically to the doctor's most recent photographs of the brightest stars. These hundred-some pictures had been taken through a prism that split starlight into its spectrum of component colors. Although the photographic process reduced the rainbow hues to black and white, the images preserved telltale patterns of lines within each spectrum. Lines that hinted at the star's constituent elements. In after-dinner conversation at the November gala, Pickering had offered to help decipher the spectral patterns by measuring them with specialized equipment at Harvard. The doctor had declined, confident that his new freedom from teaching at NYU would allow him time to build his own measuring apparatus. But now all that had changed, and so Pickering repeated the offer to Mrs. Draper. I should be greatly pleased if I might do something in memory of a friend whose talents I always admired, he wrote. Whatever may be your final arrangements regarding the great work you have undertaken, Pickering said in closing, pray recollect that if I can in any way advise or aid you, I shall be doing but little to repay Dr. Draper for a friendship which I shall always value, but which can never be replaced. Mrs. Draper rushed to reply just a few days later, January 17, 1883, on notepaper edged in black. My dear Professor Pickering, thanks so very much for your kind and encouraging letter. The only interest I can now take in life will be in having Henry's work continued. Yet I feel so very incompetent for the task that my courage sometimes completely fails me. I understand Henry's plans and his manner of working perhaps better than anyone else, but I could not get along without an assistant, and my main difficulty is to find a person sufficiently acquainted with physics, chemistry, and astronomy to carry on the various researches. I will probably find it necessary to have two assistants, one for the observatory and one for the laboratory work. For it is not likely that I will find any one person with the varied scientific knowledge that was peculiar to Henry. She was prepared to pay good salaries in order to draw the most qualified men as assistants. She and her two brothers had inherited their father's vast real estate holdings, and Henry had managed her share of the fortune to excellent effect. It is so hard that he should be taken away just as he had arranged all his affairs to have time to do the work he really enjoyed, and in which he could have accomplished so much. I cannot be reconciled to it in any way. Nevertheless, she hoped to get the work running as soon as possible under her own direction. And then, when I can buy the place at Hastings where the observatory is, to do so. Henry had built the facility on the grounds of a country retreat owned by his father, Dr. John William Draper. The elder Dr. Draper, the first physician in the family to mix medicine with active research in chemistry and astronomy, had died a widower the previous January. His will bequeathed his entire estate to his beloved spinster sister, Dorothy Catherine Draper, who had founded and run a girls' school in her youth to finance his education. It was not yet clear whether Henry's widow would win control of the Hastings property as she wished, and move Henry's Madison Avenue laboratory there, and endow the site as an institution for original research, to be named the Henry Draper Astronomical and Physical Observatory. As long as I could, I should keep the direction of the institution myself, she told Pickering. It seems the only suitable memorial I can erect to Henry, and the only way to perpetuate his name and his work. At the end, she entreated Pickering's counsel. I am so unusually alone in the world that without feeling that those friends who were interested in Henry's work would advise me, I could not do anything. Pickering encouraged her to publish her husband's findings to date, since it might take her a long time to add to them. Once again, he extended his offer to examine the glass photographic plates on the measuring machine at Harvard, if she would be so good as to send him some. Mrs. Draper agreed, but thought it best to deliver the plates in person. They were small objects, only about an inch square each. I may be obliged to go to Boston in the course of the next 10 days to attend to some business matters with one of my brothers, she wrote on January 25th. If so, I could take the negatives with me, and by going to Cambridge for part of a day, if it was convenient for you, could look over the pictures with you and see what you think of them. As arranged, she reached Summerhouse Hill above Harvard Yard on Friday morning, February 9th, accompanied by her husband's close friend and colleague, George F. Barker of the University of Pennsylvania. Barker, who was preparing a biographical memoir of Henry, had been the Drapers' house guest at the time of the Academy dinner. Late that night, when Henry was seized with a violent chill while bathing, it was Barker who helped lift him from the tub and carry him to the bedroom. Then he bid the Draper's neighbor and physician, Dr. Metcalf, another dinner guest, to return to the house immediately. Dr. Metcalf diagnosed double pleurisy. Although Henry, of course, received the most tender nursing and showed some brief promise of improvement, the infection spread to his heart. On Sunday, the doctor noted the signs of pericarditis, which precipitated Henry's death at about 4 o'clock Monday morning, the 20th of November. Mrs. Draper had visited observatories with her husband in Europe and the States, but she had not set foot inside one in months. At Harvard, the large domed building that housed the several telescopes doubled as the director's residence. Both Professor and Mrs. Pickering ushered her into the pleasant rooms and made her feel welcome. Mrs. Pickering, nay, Lizzie Wadsworth Sparks, daughter of former Harvard President Jared Sparks, did not aid her husband in his observations, as Mrs. Draper had done, but acted as the institution's vivacious and charming hostess. An exaggerated though genuine politeness characterized the directorial style of Edward Charles Pickering. If the observatory's financial straits constrained him to pay his eager young assistants meager wages, nothing prevented his addressing them respectfully as Mr. Wendell or Mr. Cutler. He called the senior astronomers Professor Rogers and Professor Searle, and all but doffed his hat and bowed to the ladies. Miss Saunders, Mrs. Fleming, Miss Farrar, and the rest, who arrived each morning to perform the necessary calculations upon the nighttime observations. Was it usual, Mrs. Draper wondered, to employ women as computers? No, Pickering told her. As far as he knew, the practice was unique to Harvard, which currently retained 6 female computers. While it would be unseemly, Pickering conceded, to subject a lady to the fatigue, not to mention the cold in winter, of telescope observing, women with a knack for figures could be accommodated in the computing room, where they did credit to the profession. Selina Bond, for example, was the daughter of the observatory's revered first director, William Cranch Bond, and also the sister of his equally revered successor, George Phillips Bond. She was currently assisting Professor William Rogers in fixing the exact positions, in the celestial equivalents of latitude and longitude, for the several thousand stars in Harvard's zone of the heavens, as part of a worldwide stellar mapping project administered by the Astronomische Gesellschaft in Germany. Professor Rogers spent every clear night at the large transit instrument, noting the times individual stars crossed the spider threads in the eyepiece. Since air, even clear air, bent the paths of light waves, shifting the stars' apparent positions, Miss Bond applied the mathematical formula that corrected Professor Rogers's notations for atmospheric effects. She used additional formulas and tables to account for other influential factors, such as Earth's progress in its annual orbit, the direction of its travel, and the wobble of its axis. Anna Winlock, like Miss Bond, had grown up at the observatory. She was the eldest child of its inventive third director, Joseph Winlock, Pickering's immediate predecessor. Winlock had died of a sudden illness in June 1875, the week of Anna's graduation from Cambridge High School. She went to work soon afterward as a computer to help support her mother and younger siblings. Wilhelmina Fleming, in contrast, could claim no familial or collegiate connection to the observatory. She had been hired in 1879 on the resident side as a second maid. Although she had taught school in her native Scotland, certain circumstances, her marriage to James Orr Fleming, her immigration to America, her husband's abrupt disappearance from her life, forced her to seek employment in a delicate condition. When Mrs. Pickering recognized the new servant's abilities, Mr. Pickering reassigned her as a part-time copyist and computer in the other wing of the building. No sooner had Mrs. Fleming mastered her tasks in the observatory than the impending birth of her baby sent her home to Dundee. She stayed there more than a year after her confinement, then returned to Harvard in 1881, having left her son, Edward Charles Pickering Fleming, in the care of her mother and grandmother. None of the projects underway at the observatory looked familiar to Mrs. Draper. Henry's amateur standing and private means had freed him to follow his own interests at the forefront of stellar photography and spectroscopy, while the professional staff here in Cambridge hewed to more traditional pursuits. They charted the heavens, monitored the orbits of planets and moons, tracked and communicated the courses of comets, and also provided time signals via telegraph to the city of Boston, six railroads, and numerous private enterprises such as the Waltham Watch Company. The work demanded both scrupulous attention to detail and a large capacity for tedium. When the 30-year-old Pickering took over as director on February 1, 1877, his primary responsibility had been to raise enough money to keep the observatory solvent. It received no support from the college to pay salaries, purchase supplies, or publish the results of its labors. Aside from interest on its endowment and income from its exact time service, the observatory depended entirely on private bequests and contributions. A decade had passed since the last solicitation for funds. Pickering soon convinced some 70 astronomy enthusiasts to pledge $50 to $200 per year for 5 years. And while those subscriptions trickled in, he sold the grass cuttings from the 6-acre observatory grounds at a small profit. They brought in about $30 a year, or enough to cover some 120 hours worth of computing time. Born and bred on Beacon Hill, Pickering navigated easily between the moneyed Boston aristocracy and the academic halls of Harvard University. In his 10 years spent teaching physics at the fledgling Massachusetts Institute of Technology, he had revolutionized instruction by setting up a laboratory where students learned to think for themselves while solving problems through experiments that he designed. Pursuing his own research at the same time, he explored the nature of light. He also built and demonstrated in 1870 a device that transmitted sound by electricity, a device identical in principle to the one perfected and patented 6 years later by Alexander Graham Bell. Pickering, however, never thought to patent any of his inventions, because he believed scientists should share ideas freely. At Harvard, Pickering chose a research focus of fundamental importance that had been neglected at most other observatories: photometry, or the measurement of the brightness of individual stars. Obvious contrasts in brightness challenged astronomers to explain why some stars outshone others. Just as they ranged in color, stars apparently came in a range of sizes and existed at different distances from Earth. Ancient astronomers had sorted them along a continuum, from the brightest of first magnitude down to sixth magnitude at the limit of naked eye perception. In 1610, Galileo's telescope revealed a host of stars never seen before, pushing the lower limit of the brightness scale to 10th magnitude. By the 1880s, large telescopes, the likes of Harvard's Great Refractor, could detect stars as faint as 14th magnitude. In the absence of uniform scales or standards, however, all estimations of magnitude remain the judgment calls of individual astronomers. Brightness, like beauty, was defined in the eye of the beholder. Pickering sought to set photometry on a sound new basis of precision that could be adopted by anyone. He began by choosing one brightness scale among the several currently in use, that of English astronomer Norman Pogson, who calibrated the ancients' star grades by presuming first magnitude stars to be precisely 100-fold brighter than those of sixth. That way, each step in magnitude differed from the next by a factor of 2.512. Pickering then chose a lone star, Polaris, the so-called pole star or north star, as the basis for all comparisons. Some of his predecessors in the 1860s had gauged starlight in relation to the flame of a kerosene lamp viewed through a pinhole, which struck Pickering as tantamount to comparing apples with oranges. Polaris, though not the sky's brightest star, was thought to give an unwavering light. It also remained fixed in space above Earth's north pole, at the hub of heavenly rotation, where its appearance was least susceptible to distortion by currents of intervening air. With Pogson's scale and Polaris as his guides, Pickering devised a series of experimental instruments, or photometers, for measuring brightness. The firm of Alvin Clark and Sons built some dozen of Pickering's designs. The early ones attached to the Great Refractor, the observatory's premier telescope, a gift from the local citizenry in 1847. Ultimately, Pickering and the Clarks constructed a superior freestanding model they called the Meridian Photometer. A dual telescope, it combined two objective lenses mounted side by side in the same long tube. The tube remained stationary, so that no time was lost in repointing it during an observing session. A pair of rotating reflective prisms brought Polaris into view through one lens and a target star through the other. The observer at the eyepiece, usually Pickering, turned a numbered dial controlling other prisms inside the instrument, and thus adjusted the two lights until Polaris and the target appeared equally bright. A second observer, most often Arthur Searle or Oliver Wendell, read the dial setting and recorded it in a notebook. The pair repeated the procedure four times per star, for several hundred stars per night, exchanging places every hour to avoid making errors due to eye fatigue. In the morning, they turned over the notebook to Miss Nettie Farrar, one of the computers, for tabulation. Taking Polaris's arbitrarily assigned magnitude of 2.1 as her base, Miss Farrar arrived at relative values for the other stars, averaged and corrected to two decimal places. By these means, it took 3 years for Pickering and his crew to pin a magnitude on every star visible from the latitude of Cambridge. The objects of Pickering's photometry studies included some 200 stars known to vary their light output over time. These variable stars, or variables, required the closest surveillance. in his 1882 report to Harvard President Charles Eliot, Pickering noted that thousands of observations were needed to establish the light cycle of any given variable. In one instance, 900 measures were made in a single night, extending without intermission from 7 o'clock in the evening until the variable had attained its full brightness at 2:30 in the morning. Pickering needed reinforcements to keep watch over the variables. Alas, in 1882, he could not afford to hire even one additional staff member. Rather than dun the observatory's loyal subscribers for more money, he issued a plea for volunteers from the ranks of amateur observers. He believed women could conduct the work as well as men. "Many ladies are interested in astronomy and own telescopes, but with two or three noteworthy exceptions, their contributions to the science have been almost nothing. Many of them have the time and inclination for such work, and especially among the graduates of women's colleges are many who have had abundant training to make excellent observers. As the work may be done at home, even from an open window, provided the room has the temperature of the outer air, there seems to be no reason why they should not thus make an advantageous use of their skill." Pickering felt, furthermore, that participating in astronomical research would improve women's social standing and justify the current proliferation of women's colleges. "The criticism is often made by the opponents of the higher education of women that, while they are capable of following others as far as men can, they originate almost nothing, so that human knowledge is not advanced by their work. This reproach would be well answered could we point to a long series of such observations as are detailed below, made by women observers." Pickering printed and distributed hundreds of copies of this open invitation, and also convinced the editors of several newspapers to publish it. Two early responses arrived in December 1882. From Eliza Crane and Mary Stockwell at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, followed by another from Sarah Wentworth of Danvers, Massachusetts. Pickering began assigning particular variables to individuals for observation. Although his volunteers lacked any equipment as sophisticated as the meridian photometer, they could compare their variables with other nearby stars and estimate the brightness changes over time. "If any of the stars become too faint," he advised them by letter, "please send word so that observations may be attempted here with the large telescope." Some women wrote to request formal instruction in practical or theoretical astronomy, but the observatory provided no such courses, nor could it admit curious spectators, male or female, at night. During the day, the director would be only too pleased to show visitors around the building. Pickering's daytime duties as director required him to correspond regularly with other astronomers, purchase books and journals for the observatory's library, attend scientific meetings, edit and publish the Annals of the Astronomical Observatory of Harvard College, oversee finances, answer inquiries by mail from the general public, host visiting dignitaries, and order supplies large and small, from telescope parts to furnace coal, stationery, pens, ledgers, even water closet paper. Every bit of observatory business demanded his personal attention, or at the very least, his signature. Only when a blanket of clouds hid the stars could he find a night's sleep. Mrs. Draper's glass plates demanded examination by daylight. Although Pickering had heard much about these images, and even discussed them with the doctor the night of the Academy dinner in November, he had not seen them till now. He was accustomed to looking at spectra, the separated rays of starlight, through the telescope, using attachments called spectroscopes that former director Joseph Winlock had purchased in the 1860s, when spectroscopy came into vogue. The live view through the spectroscope turned a star into a pale strip of colored light ranging from reddish at one end through orange, yellow, green, and blue to violet at the other. The The spectroscope also made visible many black vertical lines interspersed at intervals along the colored strip. Astronomers believed that the breadth, intensity, and spacing of these spectral lines encoded vital information. Though the code remained unbroken, a few investigators had proposed schemes to classify the stars by type, according to the similarities in their spectral line patterns. On the Draper plates, each spectrum looked like a gray smudge, barely half an inch long. Yet some contained as many as 25 lines. As Pickering viewed them under a microscope, their detail stupefied him. What skill their capture demonstrated, and what luck! He knew of only one other person in the world, Professor William Huggins of England, who had ever succeeded in capturing a stellar spectrum on a photographic plate. Huggins was also the only man of Pickering's acquaintance, aside from Dr. Draper, to have discovered an able astronomical assistant in his own wife, Margaret Lindsay Huggins. Mrs. Draper agreed to leave her plates in Pickering's care for a complete analysis and return to New York. She promised Mrs. Pickering, who was considered one of Cambridge's most accomplished gardeners, to visit again in spring or summer, in the hope of seeing the observatory grounds in full bloom. Pickering measured each spectrum with a screw thread micrometer. By February 18, 1883, he could report to Mrs. Draper that he was finding much more in the photographs than appears at first sight. The computers had plenty to do in graphing the readings from his every half turn of the screw, then applying a formula and computations to translate them into wavelengths. It became clear that Dr. Draper had demonstrated the feasibility of studying the stellar spectra by means of photography, instead of by peering through instruments and drawing a record of what the eye saw. Pickering again pressed Mrs. Draper to publish an illustrated account, not merely to establish priority for her husband, but more important, to show other astronomers the great promise of his technique. For help with the preparation of the paper, Mrs. Draper asked a noted authority on the solar spectrum, Charles A. Young of Princeton, to contribute an introduction outlining Henry's methods. Meanwhile, she cataloged all 78 plates in the spectra series, relying on Henry's notebooks to specify the date and time of each photograph taken, the star name, the length of every exposure, the telescope used, and the width of the spectroscope slit, plus incidental remarks about observing conditions, such as, there was blue fog in the sky, or the night was so windy that the dome was blown around. Pickering summarized the 21 plates he had scrutinized in 10 tables with explanations. He reported the distances between spectral lines, stating the methodology and mathematical formulas employed to translate line positions into wavelengths of light. He also commented on the similar work being done by William Huggins in London, and ventured to categorize some of Draper's spectra by Huggins's criteria. When he sent his draft to Mrs. Draper for approval, she balked at the mention of Huggins. Dr. Draper did not agree with Dr. Huggins, she wrote Pickering on April 3, 1883, concerning two of the stars in the series. Their nearly identical spectra both showed wide bands, which had made Huggins classify the two stars as a single type. But the Draper photographs revealed that one of these stars also had many fine lines between the bands, which set it apart from the other. In view of this, I should not like to accept Mr. Huggins' classification as the standard when Dr. Draper did not agree with it. Although Pickering had seen the abundance of fine lines she described, he found them too delicate for satisfactory measurement. You will not, I hope, be annoyed at my criticism, Mrs. Draper added. But I feel in publishing any of Dr. Draper's work that I want his opinions represented as nearly as possible, now that he is not here to explain them himself. The Drapers had met William and Margaret Huggins while visiting London in June 1879, at the Hugginses' home observatory on Tulse Hill. Mrs. Draper recalled Mrs. Huggins as a petite woman with short, unruly hair that stuck straight out from her head as though galvanized. She was half the age of her husband, but a full participant in his studies, both at the telescope and in the laboratory. The two couples seemed destined to become either rivals or intimates. William gave Henry the benefit of his lengthier experience by offering helpful advice about spectroscope design. He also recommended a new type of dry, pre-treated photographic plate that had lately come on the market. There was no need to paint liquid emulsion on these plates just prior to exposing them, and consequently they allowed for much longer exposure times. Before leaving England, the Drapers purchased a supply of Ratten and Wainwright's London Ordinary Gelatin Dry Plates, which proved a boon indeed. They were particularly sensitive to the ultraviolet wavelengths of light, beyond the range of human vision. Unlike the old wet plates, the dry ones created a permanent record suitable for precision measurement. The dry plates gave the Drapers the wherewithal to photograph the spectra of the stars. The paper announcing the stellar spectra findings, by the late Henry Draper, M.D., LL.D., appeared in the Proceedings of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in February 1884. Pickering mailed copies to prominent astronomers everywhere. By return mail, dated March 12th, he received William Huggins's indignant reaction. Huggins found some of Pickering's measurements very wild, the letter said with emphasis. I should be glad if you could see your way to look into this, because it would be better that you should discover the error and publish the correction than that the matter should be pointed out by others. My wife unites in kind regards to you and Mrs. Pickering. Pickering was certain he had not erred. And, as Huggins had never explicated his measurement procedures, Pickering stood firmly by his own. As they traded charges, Pickering forwarded Huggins's letter to Mrs. Draper. Now it was her turn to grow indignant. I felt very sorry, she wrote Pickering on April 30th, 1884, that you should have been subjected to such an ungentlemanly attack through your interest in Dr. Draper's work. Before returning the letters to Pickering, she took the liberty of copying one, since it is worth preserving as a curiosity of epistolatory literature. During this same time, Pickering was seeking assistants who might help Mrs. Draper advance her husband's work to the next stage. He considered former director Joseph Winlock's son, William Crawford Winlock, currently employed at the U.S. Naval Observatory, to be a very likely prospect. But Mrs. Draper rejected him. To her regret, she could not induce her preferred candidate, Thomas Mendenhall, to leave his professorship at Ohio State University. She channeled some of her frustration into the creation of the Henry Draper Gold Medal, to be awarded periodically by the National Academy of Sciences for outstanding achievements in astronomical physics. She gave the Academy $6,000 to endow the prize fund, and spent another $1,000 commissioning an artist in Paris to fashion a metal die featuring Henry's likeness. The spring of 1884 brought Pickering new money worries. The successful 5-year subscriptions from generous astronomy enthusiasts had run their course, ending the accustomed annual stipend of $5,000. The director was covering various operating expenses out of his own salary, and even so, was forced to let go 5 assistants. In a touching show of solidarity, observatory colleagues took up a collection to retain one of those who had been dismissed, and furnished part of the required sum, Pickering told his circle of advisors, from their own scanty means. He appreciated the extraordinary efforts on the part of the observers who have performed without assistance the work in which they were previously aided by recorders. This has required an increase in the time spent in observation and has rendered the work much more laborious. While this evidence of enthusiasm and devotion to science is most gratifying, it is obvious that it cannot long be continued without injury to health. Indeed, the effects of overfatigue and exposure during the long cold nights of last winter were manifest in more than one instance. The motto on the Pickering family coat of arms, Nil Desperandum, plus the lifelong habit of his own 37 years, obliged the director to substitute resourcefulness and resilience for despair. He began formulating a means of combining Mrs. Draper's wishes and wealth with the capabilities and needs of his observatory. I am making plans for a somewhat extensive piece of work in stellar photography in which I hope that you may be interested, he informed her in a letter of May 17, 1885. Pickering intended to redirect most of the observatory's projects along photographic lines. His predecessors, the Bonds, had recognized the promise of photography and achieved the first photograph of a star in 1850. But the limitations of the wet plates had impeded further attempts. With the new dry plates, possibilities multiplied. Determinations of stellar brightness and variability would surely prove easier and more accurate on photographs, which could be examined, re-examined, and compared at will. A methodical program for photographing the entire sky would transform the painstaking process of zone mapping. As a bonus, these photographs would reveal untold numbers of unknown faint stars, invisible even through the world's biggest telescopes, because the sensitive plate, unlike the human eye, could gather light and aggregate images over time. Pickering's younger brother, William, a recent graduate of MIT, was already teaching photographic technique there and testing the limits of the art by trying to photograph objects in motion. The 27-year-old William had consented to assist Edward in a few photographic experiments with the Harvard telescope. One of their pictures yielded 462 stars in a region where only 55 had been previously documented. The part of Pickering's plan with the greatest potential interest for Mrs. Draper concerned a new approach to photographing stellar spectra. Rather than focus on one target star at a time, a la Draper or Huggins, Pickering anticipated group portraits of all the brightest stars in a wide field of view. To achieve these, he envisioned a new instrument setup combining telescope and spectroscope with the type of lens used in the studios of portrait photographers. I think there will be no difficulty in carrying out this plan without your aid, he assured Mrs. Draper. On the other hand, if it commends itself to you, I am confident that we could make it conform to such conditions as you might impose. Thanks for your kindness, she replied on May 21st, 1885, in remembering my desire to be interested in some work with which Dr. Draper's name could be associated and his memory kept alive. I will be glad to cooperate, if I can, in what you suggest, for its bearing on stellar spectrum photography appeals to me very strongly. More than 2 years had passed since Henry's death. Still unable to make his observatory productive, she saw no harm in lending his name to Harvard. Pickering proceeded slowly and with caution, apprising her of his progress until he could send her some sample images of stellar spectra taken through his new apparatus. She found them exceedingly interesting. On January 31st, 1886, she said, I would be willing, if the plan could be carried out satisfactorily, to authorize the expenditure of $200 a month or somewhat more if necessary. Pickering thought more would be needed. They settled terms on Valentine's Day for the Henry Draper Memorial, an ambitious photographic catalog of stellar spectra gathered on glass plates. Its goal was the classification of several thousand stars according to their various spectral types, just as Henry had set out to do. All results would be published in the annals of the Harvard College Observatory. On February 20, 1886, Mrs. Draper sent Pickering a check for $1,000, the first of many installments. Pickering publicized the new undertaking in all the usual places, including Science, Nature, and the Boston and New York newspapers. Later that spring, Mrs. Draper decided to increase her already generous gift by donating one of Henry's telescopes. She visited Cambridge in May to make the arrangements. Since the instrument needed a new mounting, something Henry had meant to build himself, she asked George Clark of Alvin Clark and Sons to fabricate the parts at a cost of $2,000 and to oversee the transfer of the equipment from Hastings to Harvard. Once arrived, it would require its own small building with a dome 18 feet in diameter, and Mrs. Draper meant to cover that expense as well. Together with the Pickerings, she strolled among the plantings of rare trees and shrubs around the observatory to select a site for the new addition. Chapter 2. What Miss Maury Saw. The infusion of funds for the Henry Draper Memorial made the Harvard College Observatory hum with new people and purpose. Construction of the small building to house Dr. Draper's telescope started in June 1886 and continued through the summer while Mrs. Draper toured Europe. In October, the instrument was mounted in the new dome. Now there were two telescopes outfitted for nightly rounds of spectral photography. The Draper 11-inch and an 8-inch purchased with a $2,000 grant from the Bache Fund of the National Academy of Sciences. The illustrious Great Refractor, through which the first ever photograph of a star had been taken in 1850, later proved unsuitable for photography. Its 15-inch lens had been fashioned for visual observing, that is, for human eyes most attuned to yellow and green wavelengths of light. The lenses of the two new instruments, in contrast, favored the bluer wavelengths to which photographic plates were sensitive. The 8-inch Bache telescope also boasted a wide field of view for taking in huge tracts of sky all at once, rather than homing in on single objects. In less than a decade at the helm, Edward Pickering had shifted the observatory's institutional emphasis from old astronomy, centered on star positions, to novel investigations into the star's physical nature. While half the computing staff continued to calibrate the locations and orbital dynamics of heavenly bodies, a few of the women were learning to read the glass plates produced on site, honing their skills in pattern recognition in addition to arithmetic. A new kind of star catalog would soon emerge from these activities. The earliest known star counter, Hipparchus of Nicaea, cataloged 1,000 stars in the 2nd century BC, and later astronomers enumerated the content of the heavens to ever better effect. The projected Henry Draper catalog would be the first in history to rely entirely on photographs of the sky and to specify the spectrum type as well as the position and brightness for myriad stars. Dr. and Mrs. Draper had gathered their spectra one by one, using a prism at the telescope's eyepiece to split the light of each star. Pickering and his assistants, eager to increase the pace of operations, altered the Draper's approach. By installing prisms at the objective or light-gathering end of the telescope instead of at the eyepiece, they were able to capture group portraits containing 200 or 300 spectra per plate. The prisms were large, square sheets of thick glass, wedge-shaped in cross-section. The safety and convenience of handling the prisms, Pickering found, is greatly increased by placing them in square brass boxes, each of which slides into place like a drawer. Harvard's picture gallery grew apace. When Mrs. Draper paid another visit soon after Thanksgiving, Pickering assured her that any star visible from Cambridge appeared on at least one of the glass plates. Toward the end of December 1886, just when the staff had smoothed out most of the difficulties with the new procedures, Nettie Farrar's beau proposed. Pickering was all in favor of marriage, of course, but he hated to lose Miss Farrar, a 5-year veteran of the computing corps, whom he had personally trained to measure spectra on the photographic plates. On New Year's Eve, he wrote to inform Mrs. Draper of Miss Farrar's engagement, and also to name Wilhelmina Fleming, the former maid, as her replacement. Since returning from Scotland in 1881, Mrs. Fleming had been assisting Pickering with photometry. Often she took the director's penciled notations from the nightly observations with his assistants and applied the formulas he specified to compute the star's magnitudes. By 1886, when the Royal Astronomical Society awarded Pickering its gold medal for this work, he had already embarked on a parallel approach to photometry via photography. This change required Mrs. Fleming, well accustomed to reading lists of numbers scribbled in the dark, to judge magnitudes from fields of stars on glass plates. Mrs. Fleming had let Pickering know that photography ran in her pedigree. Her father, Robert Stevens, a carver and gilder praised for his gold leaf picture frames, had been the first in the city of Dundee to experiment with daguerreotyping, as the process was called in her childhood. She was still a child, only 7, when her father died suddenly of heart failure. Her mother and older siblings tried for a time to keep the business running without him, but without success. One by one, her older brothers sailed away to Boston, where she eventually followed them. Now, at 29, she had a 7-year-old child of her own to care and provide for. Edward would soon arrive. Her mother was booking passage with him on the Prussian out of Glasgow. Miss Farrar dutifully introduced Mrs. Fleming to the plates of stellar spectra and taught her how to measure the hordes of tiny lines. Mrs. Fleming could have taught Miss Farrar a thing or two about marriage and childbirth, but on the subject of the spectrum, she had everything to learn. The young Isaac Newton coined the word spectrum in 1666 to describe the rainbow colors that arose like ghostly apparitions when daylight passed through cut glass or crystal. Although his contemporaries thought glass corrupted the purity of light by imparting color to it, Newton held that colors belong to light itself. A prism merely revealed white light's component hues by refracting them at different angles so that each could be seen individually. The microscopic dark lines within the stellar spectra, to which Mrs. Fleming now directed her attention, were called Fraunhofer lines, after Joseph von Fraunhofer of Bavaria, their discoverer. A glazier's son, Fraunhofer had apprenticed at a mirror factory and gone on to become a master crafter of telescope lenses. In 1816, in order to measure the exact degree of refraction in different glass recipes and lens configurations, he built a device that combined a prism with a surveyor's small telescope. When he directed a beam of light from the prism through a slit and into the instrument's magnified field of view, he beheld a long, narrow rainbow marked by many dark lines. Repeated trials convinced him that the lines, like the rainbow colors, were not artifacts of passage through glass, but inherent in sunlight. Fraunhofer's lens testing apparatus was the world's first spectroscope. Charting his finds, Fraunhofer labeled the most prominent lines with letters of the alphabet. A for the wide black one at the rainbow's extreme red end, D for a dark double stripe in the orange-yellow range, and so on through the blue and violet to a pair named H, and ending farther along the violet with I. Fraunhofer's lines retained their original alphabetical designations through the decades following his death, gaining greater importance as later scientists observed, mapped, interpreted, measured, and depicted them with fine-nib pens. In 1859, chemist Robert Bunsen and physicist Gustav Kirchhoff, working together in Heidelberg, translated the Fraunhofer lines of the sun's spectrum into evidence for the presence of specific earthly substances. They heated numerous purified elements to incandescence in the laboratory and showed that each one's flame produced its own characteristic spectral signature. Sodium, for example, emitted a close-set pair of bright orange-yellow streaks. These correlated in wavelength with the dark doublet of lines that Fraunhofer had labeled D. It was as though the laboratory sample of burning sodium had colored in those particular dark gaps in the sun's rainbow. From a series of such congruities, Kirchhoff concluded that the sun must be a fireball of multiple burning elements, shrouded in a gaseous atmosphere. As light radiated through the sun's outer layers, the bright emission lines from the solar conflagration were absorbed in the cooler surrounding atmosphere, leaving dark telltale gaps in the solar spectrum. Astronomers, many of whom had considered the sun a temperate, potentially habitable world, were shocked to learn of its inferno-like heat. However, they were soon placated, even soothed, by the revelatory power of spectroscopy to expose the chemical content of the firmament. Spectrum analysis, Henry Draper told the Young Men's Christian Association of New York in 1866, has made the chemist's arms millions of miles long. Throughout the 1860s, pioneering spectroscopists such as William Huggins discerned Fraunhofer lines in the spectra of other stars. In 1872, Henry Draper began photographing them. While the number of spectral lines in starlight paled in comparison to the rich tapestry of the sun's spectrum, several recognizable patterns emerged. It seemed that the stars, which had for so long been loosely categorized by brightness or color, could now be further assorted according to spectral features hinting at their true nature. In 1866, Father Angelo Secchi of the Vatican Observatory divided 400 stellar spectra into four distinct types, which he designated by Roman numerals. Secchi's class 1 contained brilliant blue-white stars, such as Sirius and Vega, whose spectra shared four strong lines indicating the presence of hydrogen. Class 2 included the Sun and yellowish stars like it, with spectra full of many fine lines identifying iron, calcium, and other elements. Classes 3 and 4 both consisted of red stars, differentiated by the patterns in their dark spectral bands. Pickering challenged Mrs. Fleming to improve on this elementary class system. Whereas Secchi had sketched his spectra from direct observations of a few hundred stars, she would enjoy the advantage of the Henry Draper Memorial photographs, boasting thousands of spectra for her scrutiny. The glass plates preserved more faithful portrayals of the positions of Fraunhofer's lines than drawings could ever provide. Also, the plates picked up lines at the far violet end of the spectrum, at wavelengths the eye could not see. Mrs. Fleming removed each glass plate from its craft paper sleeve without getting a single fingerprint on either of the 8x10-inch surfaces. The trick was to hold the fragile packet by its side edges between her palms, set the bottom, open end of the envelope on the lip of the specially designed stand,